From Cambridge 105, this is Election Studio.
Welcome to the Election Studio. I'm Julian Clover. In the second of these two programmes, we'll be hearing from the candidates in the Police and Crime Commissioner elections. On last week's show, we spoke to Labour's Dave Bagent and Conservative Jason Abelwhite, and you can hear those interviews on the Cambridge 105 website. Today, we speak to UKIP's Nick Clarke, but first, Liberal Democrat Rupert Moss-Eckardt. Rupert Moss-Eckardt is the only candidate to stand in both this and the previous Police and Crime Commissioner election. He was previously a county councillor in Arbury and works as a security consultant. Rupert, welcome to Cambridge 105. You're having a second attempt, I believe, at being the Police and Crime Commissioner for the Liberal Democrats.
Yes, indeed.
What did you learn last time?
It was quite interesting. One of the things I learnt last time was, up to the election itself, people assumed that anyone standing for election had no other task, had no job, had nothing to do apart from the campaign. And that wasn't true then. It isn't true now. I have a day job, which is challenging and exciting. Obviously give it up if I get elected. What I also learned was that there were an awful lot of pressure groups who were very keen to be heard. What was also obvious is that the electorate had no real understanding of what the Police and Crime Commissioner would do for them or could do for them. And I'm afraid that hasn't changed much either.
I was going to ask about that because last time around, I think the figure was something like 15% of the electorate chose to vote, which doesn't give anybody, poor Sir Graham, a particularly sweeping mandate with that.
Indeed. I mean, the problem with last time was it was in November. Like this time, the election's being run by the Home Office, who have no real grasp of democracy. Interestingly, this time, with a number of local elections taking place at the same time, it is likely that many PCCs will have more votes cast for them than MPs, and even losing PCCs candidates will also have more votes than successful MPs. We've got a 600,000 electorate here in Cambridgeshire and Peterborough. Even on last figures, if you did really well, you're talking about 20,000 votes or so, which is more than many MPs got to win.
In terms of the awareness thing, do you believe that to be a national problem, or is that something which is, I say, specific to Cambridgeshire? I suspect there's possibly other districts and regions of the country where there may also very well be a local awareness problem as well.
Indeed. I mean, many of the forces across the country, nobody knows who the PCC is. Haven't seen much of them. Some places the PCC has been more active, more visible. And some places, South Yorkshire, for example, where the chief constable's now been suspended, clearly people now know who the PCC is, or at least have seen the name. Mm. It is a national problem. It's a problem with political activity in general in the UK, in that if you've got money of your own, if you've got or sufficiently large backers, yes, you can buy almost an election. If you don't, then you don't get the chance.
Do you think that's true?
I think if I had, say...
Because party political broadcasts, for example, are quite even. The Green Party, who aren't actually putting up a candidate, at least in Cambridgeshire, in the elections, would complain, I suspect, about what's been allocated or not been allocated to them.
Well, but indeed, Police and Crime Commission elections, there's no what they call the free post. If this was a parliamentary election, I could send a letter to each household in the area with my offer, as it were, what I want to say. For PCC elections, there's no free post. There's no real national drive to make people aware. I mean, there's been a few things done. Some of that perhaps is by choice. Some of it's because, you know, people focus on Parliament, on the Westminster bubble, and indeed the devolved parliaments too. If I had, say, £150,000 spare, I think I'd get a very good chance of winning with no branding, with no other effort, but by writing to each household, each individual voter, doing some phone campaigning, doing some ads in the cinemas elsewhere, you'd go very far to winning without actually having much to say.
So are you blaming the system before the vote has even taken place?
Well, to an extent, but I think it's an overall problem, not just for the PCC elections, but other elections too, that because of the way the political system works in the UK, people may know their local councillors if they're in a politically active area. In an area which has been run by the same party forever, people don't get to see much of their elected representatives. Parliament is a distant place. Some MPs are very active in their own areas, some aren't. And a lot of it is the first time people think about elections and politics is on the day. And some of that's to do with the media, some of that's to do with things. Though it's interesting, when Churchill first stood for a parliament in 20-odd, he took the main front page of a broadsheet paper and the page inside to describe what he intended to do. And the electorate talked about it a lot. We don't get that anymore. People don't get informed in the same way as they used to.
Do you think that there's the danger with this a vote for all candidates, not necessarily just yourself, that we get into the little booth on polling day on Thursday, and I'm not putting it across because that's not how the system works, but we just basically say, right, number one, that's going to be the party I voted for in the last election because that's nearest to what I believe.
That is part of what does happen.
Which gives you a close second in Cambridge and well behind in Peterborough.
Yeah, there will be a certain amount of that. People will vote the way they've always voted. A challenge the Liberal Democrats have always had is, apart from people like the Bonham Carters, there is not a family history of voting for a particular party. So somebody's parents will have voted Conservative and grandparents too. They may well go down that route themselves unless something has changed. So for us to get voters, even in other elections, we have to convert people from what they're used to voting. It's changing a bit. We're now in a generation where some people may have only voted Lib Dem all their lives. So people do vote for the brand. I mean, it helps in some ways because they know what they're going to get. If you vote for a Conservative candidate, you have a rough idea generally of how they might
think. What are people
going
to get? People vote Lib Dem in Cambridgeshire for Police and Crime Commissioner. What are they going to get from you?
They're going to get somebody who does evidence-led, proven techniques for reducing crime, for reducing harm, a more thoughtful approach to crime reduction and managing the police to make sure it's done based on real numbers, based on understanding.
Where are you going to get those from? You're a security consultant, I believe, in the present job. Is expertise from there or from elsewhere?
A bit of both. So I have in the past worked and helped set up the National Centre for Policing Excellence, which helped develop doctrine in policing, i.e. approved ways of doing things. That became split into the National Crime Agency and the College for Policing. The College for Policing does a ton of work on both more publicly accessible, and there's a website called What Works. If you search for it on Google, it tells about crime reduction measures. Internally, they do other things. At the moment, for example, they are drafting some professional practice on how to do stop and search in a more fair and effective way. Cambridgeshire isn't very good at stop and search. It has performed poorly in its last assessment. There is plenty of research out there. Here in Cambridge, there is the Institute of Criminology. Lawrence Sherman and his colleagues do very useful, interesting work about how crime can be reduced, how other things, investigations can be improved. The Susie Lamplugh Trust do that sort of thing as well. There are lots of groups who, because they've had difficulty in the past or because they have an interest, are working very hard at proper peer-reviewed research on how to do policing. And then, of course, out in the field, there's plenty of research being done too to assess how things are successful.
And then how do you apply that in your direction to the police? Everybody who sits in the chair where you are now will tell me what their priorities are, and surprise, surprise, it's to reduce crime. But there's different types of crime and there's a different emphasis on different issues. Where would your emphasis be?
So nationally, of course, there are some big crime areas that need to be reduced. There is the focus on harm reduction will help drive where you prioritise your crime reduction.
And harm reduction is what?
Making sure people don't suffer. It's not just injuries. It's in the broadest sense, if people aren't happy to go out at night or even during the day because they feel they're in a high crime area, that is a harm in itself. So making sure that we focus effort and enthusiasm on those areas where we can have the best and greatest effect on the lives of the individual in society, in the community. At the same time, there are local neighbourhood policing teams across the county. Setting their priorities is best done in those communities, in front of the local people, with local leaders helping, so the local people have a control over what's prioritised for them. And that actually is a positive feedback loop. If people think the police are back to being policing by consent, doing what the community wants, they get more involved, there's better coherence, and the police force can become more effective because people take an interest in what's going on.
Do you think there's too much of a distance, are we saying then, between the police and, well, people like you and me, really, I suppose, and civilians and everyday life?
Yes. I mean, when Sir Robert Peel set up the police service in the 19th century, he was very clear that the police should just be like us, but doing stuff that we would like to do but couldn't do because we didn't have the time to do it. He says words along those lines in his formation of the Metropolitan Police. Heading back towards that is what we need to do. We need to be able to think that a police officer of whatever description is just one of us and doing something we'd like to do too, but don't have the time for. So there is this distance. There, the vehicle problem that people see a police car going past, don't know who's in it. There is also, even the uniforms are tending to more military and less policing. And that's an unfortunate side effect of what's going on in the world.
Does the uniform affect how good a policeman's job is? Surely we just want them to, you know, to go out and catch the crooks.
But if you see somebody who's wearing a NATO helmet, a full or semi-body armour, stab vest, all the gadgetry, they aren't quite as lovable as your local copper.
Well, in some places, they need them to protect themselves, which seems particularly reasonable.
Indeed, yes. But it's still one of those things that sets distance.
So things like the cameras, which I believe...
Body-worn
videos. whatever technical name, we'll call them the cameras, which some police wear. I think it's being rolled out to majority of them in Cambridgeshire. Would you not have those devices?
No, the body-worn video is a great thing in that it does help both the serving officers and the public get an idea of what's really gone on. It is a shame it's become necessary, but that's... if you go to one of the police training centres, there's one in Bruges, in Warrington, for example, on the wall of the canteen there is the oath the police have sworn and now swear. In the 19th century, it was keep the king or queen's peace, depending on the time of the century it was, and not much more. Right at the right-hand end in the modern world, there's an awful lot about racism, sexism, corruption, all those things, because unfortunately, over the years, things have gone wrong in policing and it's become felt necessary that we build behaving yourself correctly into the oath. The same thing goes with body-worn video. If there hadn't been bad apples ruining for the rest, that wouldn't be quite so necessary. And one of the things that I would like us to drive out from policing and elsewhere too is what is might be shorthand is canteen culture. The idea that if your colleague does something wrong, you don't mention it because you need to support them more than you support the overall police service. So it's a bit about collective responsibility needs to be driven in as well.
You'll be familiar, I'm sure, with the events in Hillsborough, particularly in recent days. The South Yorkshire Chief Constable, a gentleman by the name of David Crompton, suspended over his response to the disaster, let alone the disaster and all the issues there affecting South Yorkshire Police. And the police commissioner in place there, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Alan Billings, says he based his decision on comments made in the House of Commons, I guess the Home Secretary's speech, and also public calls for the Chief Constable's resignation. I'm wondering how you might have handled all of that. Would you have waited until it was a news story before you acted?
I don't think so. I mean, I think, as I understand it, though I don't have all the detail, the Chief Constable did send emails out during the earlier inquest, as well as the start of this one, with statements that were not true and clearly structured to disparage the witnesses. And that is just plain wrong, whether it be the Hillsborough thing or a simple bit of burglary. So the Chief Constable showed an error of judgment that should not be at a senior officer level. So I'd have possibly either gone for words of advice or suspension. Something went terribly wrong in Hillsborough all those years ago and continued to go wrong as the force continued to try and protect itself rather than protect the community. So I don't think it's just one or two officers or several, as it seems to be already. There's a more deep-seated
problem. It seems to be. We can't prejudge anything with inquiries on the way, but it seems to be pretty much a culture issue. And from your perspective, you need to manage that culture, don't you, within a force?
So some years ago when I was in a training organisation, one of our training cars had an accident, breathalysed both observer and driver, because in the law, the person telling the driver where to go counts as being in control of the vehicle too. One of them was slightly over the limit. What was interesting is that went round the centre quite rapidly, but when the head of centre called in the head of training and said, "What's happened here?" her first question was, "Who told you?" Which is not the right question and not the right way to deal with it. There is still an awful lot of protectionism within the service that just needs to be... The important thing is to have a culture where if you make a mistake, you say so, you learn from it, and if it was done in, you know, in good faith, you don't get second-guessed by your senior officers, you get supported. But there seems to be an awful lot of this difficulty that people aren't willing to step up. So one of the reasons why a PCC should exist is if the force has done all the right things based on the evidence they had and it still goes wrong, they get protected by the PCC, they don't get hounded by him or her.
In terms of your priorities, I'm wondering how you might handle the issue of drugs.
Well, it's back to harm reduction again. At Lib Dem conference this spring, we voted in, and I was enthusiastic in voting for it, a policy to decriminalise but regulate the consumption and supply of cannabis. This reduces harm to the society, it actually generates some revenue too, but also reduces harm to individuals as well.
I think the figure was given at the time was about £1 billion.
Well, yes, I mean, that's a nice big number. But actually, the important thing with that is if someone starts taking cannabis and has a difficulty with it, they're able to report it, get help with it. We take it out of the hands of criminals so that this level of crime that's just to do with cannabis supply goes away. And by removing the harmful types of cannabis, the ones at the wrong end, as it were, again, you reduce harm. As Brian Paddock said when he was a commander in the Met, the police are wasted on cannabis. It's not the way you should put effort. Tom Lloyd, former chief constable in Cambridgeshire, has the same view. If you look at the evidence and work it through, it makes more sense to ban alcohol than cannabis. But actually, we regulate both.
Without going into, I guess, the Lib Dem drug policy, how do you then apply that onto the streets of Cambridge, for example, where there are issues from time to time with people coming in, selling drugs? They're not necessarily from Cambridge, perhaps coming from London and from other areas, trying to extend their territory. It surely leads to crime.
Absolutely, and it is a crime. Supply of drugs is a crime. So you pursue them in the same way as you pursue all other criminals. However, if somebody is found with, obviously, a personal amount of cannabis, pushing them through the criminal justice system is not really in the public interest. However, tracking down who their supplier is and dealing with them is in the public interest. Look at the harm, make decisions based on harm. Not try and get headlines, not try and look like you're going for this ridiculous idea of zero tolerance. Zero tolerance is a nonsense. It gets in the way. It reduces effectiveness of policing. To pick an example, in Ely, parking is still enforced by the police. There are parking bays that say 20 hundredweight maximum weight because they were created in the 60s. My car weighs more than that. If I park there, I commit a crime. I cannot believe it's anyone's interest to prosecute people for parking a modern car in a parking
space.
And
I doubt anybody would try to pursue it either at any level.
Well, except we
have
somebody talking about zero tolerance. When you talk about zero tolerance, either you do or you don't.
Have you ever been a victim of crime yourself?
Oh, yes, I've had. I've been burgled twice. I've been assaulted once. Obviously, a small amount of fraud, as everybody has, but my card provider dealt with it sensibly and very effectively.
Did you contact the police at the time on any of those?
The assault or the burglary? The burglaries, both burglaries, we had proper scenes of crime turn up, or scientific support investigation, as it should be called, doing the right things, came up with a good theory of crime for one of them. Obviously, not much outcome. Both were low-level crime, as it were. They did the right thing, dealt with me in a way I was confident they were doing their best. The assault was much more in a general melee during a public order event, as they call it. I was taking part in the We Won't Stand Alone campaign for the National Union of Students on Westminster Bridge in 1980-something.
Right,
Didn't work very well. One of those student issues, perhaps
on that. Would you direct, you know, in the light of your experience, you know, particularly on the burglary, perhaps, would you direct the police to handle, not necessarily for you, and I hope it doesn't happen to you or anybody else again, but for those it does happen to, would you point the police slightly differently?
The way they dealt with my burglary, especially most recently, was, you know, best practice. It worked as well as it could be given the evidence available. I think one of the things is if a prosecution, or rather a perpetrator is discovered, one of the things I'm very big on is restorative justice. If you're burgled and the burglar gets absorbed into the criminal justice system and goes off through the court system, you never see them again, it doesn't give closure. It doesn't necessarily mean that the punishment fits the crime. Where appropriate, and with the agreement of the victim, having an interview with the perpetrator can be a very powerful way of achieving closure and often puts burglars off. Professional burglars don't like talking to the victims. It makes it more human. They prefer to view it as a sort of a job, and it isn't that, of course. And it is amazing. I encourage all your listeners to look up Restorative Justice on the Internet, read about it. It is a fantastic way of reducing crime and reducing harm.
Now, you've previously been a councillor in Arbury.
Yep.
And you've also stood for Parliament in southwest Norfolk.
Yes.
I'm just trying to remember, would that have been up against Daniel Zeichner, or would that have been a different time?
No. So in southwest Norfolk, I was standing against Liz Truss.
Okay. All right. That's interesting. And I know that Daniel had stood in that that constituency in the past. Mm-hmm. I guess the question here is, if you don't make it this time around, would you look to get a parliamentary seat again or return to a council office? What would you want to do?
I've always attempted to do some public service of one sort or another. I've been in the public sector at times, and occasionally that's been, obviously clearly developed, although employed, doing a public service. I've been a councillor, I've been a custody visitor, I've been on the ID parade panel, I've been a subject of experiments by the Applied Psychology Unit. All things, and I do have this drive still to do my bit for society. Obviously, getting elected to PCC would be a fantastic way of doing that. If not, then I shall still, where an opportunity presents itself, put myself forward for it.
Okay. Well, Rupert Mosakard, thank you very much joining us in the election studio. We're asking all of our guests to pick a piece of music to end the interview with. And what have you chosen?
I've chosen Shut Up by Madness. It's quite an old track. For those of you familiar with the video, you'll see why.
Rupert, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's Madness and Shut Up. It's the choice of the Lib Dem candidate in the Police and Crime Commissioner elections, Rupert Mosakard. And we'll get the views of UKIP's Nick Clark when Election Studio continues.
From Cambridge 105, this is Election Studio.
Welcome back to the Election Studio. My next guest is UKIP's Nick Clark, a businessman. Mr. Clark has previously been the leader of Cambridgeshire County Council, but lost his Foulbourne seat in the 2013 local elections. In April 2015, he defected to UKIP, claiming the party would protect our way of life for our children and our grandchildren. Nick, welcome back to the Election Studio. You were here a year or so ago representing UKIP, although not actually standing for Parliament doing those elections. Previously, though, you'd been leader of Cambridgeshire County Councils with the Conservative, which you left the party for UKIP. Do you not think to yourself sometime that you might have been a shoe-in for this job if you've actually stayed with the Conservatives?
Well, that would be for other people to say, I guess, but that really wasn't the point. I've not been a lifelong politician. I think I fell into politics later in life, and I'm much more driven about how politics affects the people of Cambridgeshire, and I was incredibly frustrated with my dealings with Conservative ministers about their complete lack of focus and understanding on the benefits, merits and application of local authority work. It's a complete disgrace that so many people are suffering unnecessarily, which I believe that to be the case. And of course, I have a particular view on the EU and the fact that I believe we should be leaving. So they were the reasons I moved across to UKIP. And I've always believed that when politicians take themselves too seriously, then it's time to quit. And it should be much more about the issues.
Mm. And as an aside then, as you bring up the issue of local government and how it works, how do you feel that the proposals for that East Anglian powerhouse have been applied? Is that good, bad?
I guess you're talking about the devolution deal.
I am indeed, yes.
Yeah, well, look, I think it's the wrong deal for Cambridgeshire. It doesn't reflect the value that Cambridgeshire brings to the partnership there. And, of course, it's slightly schizophrenic because, on one hand, the government is saying you must look for devolution to Norfolk and Suffolk. At the same time, it's had a strong hand saying Cambridgeshire Constabulary, you must look towards collaboration with Beds and Hertfordshire.
And there's already been some teams which have been merged already, hasn't there?
Yeah, there's lots of stuff going on there. So there's a slightly schizophrenic feeling about this. My own view on the devolution deal, and I don't blame everything on Europe because that's not appropriate, but this does smack of the government needing to bring back the concept of regions like we used to have in order to meet some of the requirements from the EU, and probably as a result of David Cameron's negotiations, because it came through very quickly that the original deal for devolution was for Norfolk and Suffolk to get together, and suddenly at the last minute, Cambridge was thrust in there as well. The wrong deal, the money's not big enough, and I don't think it will work.
OK, let's talk about the issue in hand, of course, the election for the Police and Crime Commissioner, which you're standing for, UKIP. You've been a police cadet, you've sat on a local police authority as well. What do you think you'll bring to this role, should you be elected on Thursday?
Well, I think I have the relevant experience for this role. I've served in the RAF for 22 years, so I have a background in uniformed services. I've run successful companies. And of course, as you say, I've been an independent member of Cambridge's police authority. But I guess more recently, I was the leader of Cambridgeshire County Council, having to deal with all the issues that the constabulary are having to deal with now, the reduced budgets, trying to get more out of the money that's available in a county that is the fastest growing county in the country. I think I have good experience in managing large organisations and a track record of success.
So does that mean that you might be looking to lobby government for more funding for Cambridgeshire, perhaps, who knows, in partnership with your opposite number in Bedfordshire, perhaps, and Hertfordshire, if that's the way that the police is going to be managed, but to bring more funding in to deal with the crime?
Without a shadow of a doubt, in the last few years, the government has not recognised the needs for protecting law and order, in the same way that it hasn't recognised that funding for local authorities is essential to the lives of real people. Clearly, we police with the consent of the public in this country, which means we have a relatively small number of police officers per head of population. But that will only work and continue to work if there are sufficient police out there that the general public can bump into them, can meet them, can talk to them, to pass on the low-grade intelligence that often leads to the big crimes being solved.
So a visibility issue in part.
If you talk to people across the county, as I have, I'm sure as all the candidates have, the biggest single thing they're telling me is that they just never see a police officer.
You see a lot of where, as I wander around Cambridge, as I do quite frequently, as you might imagine, you see, and I have this habit, you look at the back of the jacket, is it police or is it a police support officer? Now, there's quite a few police and support officers around Cambridge. Can they not pass that information back to their colleagues? I don't wish to denigrate the role that the support staff do, but to pass to the higher policeman, as it were, to do it, filter through in the way you suggest?
Well, of course they could, but there are less of those as well. I mean, since 2010, police officer numbers across Cambridgeshire have dropped by 8%. That's a huge difference. That's 100 to 150 officers or PCSO combination that we no longer have available for the general public to meet. And, policing in this country has traditionally been about people trusting their police officers, passing them information to help solve crimes. But more importantly, they act as a deterrent. If people think they're going to go and try and break the law, if they see a police officer or a PCSO walking along the streets, they're much less likely to do that. And it's about changing our focus a little bit and concentrating a little bit more on harm rather than crimes, because I would like to put up crime figures hugely, because I would like to have a zero tolerance on the supply of illegal drugs. So the paradox is we put lots of effort in there, reducing harm because less people will have drugs available. But, of course, the crime figures will go up. Look, crime has increased, hasn't it? Because we're now arresting a lot more criminals who are taking or supplying drugs. So there has to be some clever thinking between harm, which we must reduce, and crime.
Mm. A couple of points from that. The first, of course, is that you end up with the budget you're given, I suppose, really, from national government, or at least the police do. And as a crime commissioner, you'd have to try to direct the police into the way that you believed was correct. They presumably from time to time would disagree, and other times would say, yes, that's exactly what we want to do. So it's a tricky operation, isn't it? If you're you get the budget and then you have to apportion it, even though at the same time you're knocking on doors for more money. Ultimately, you end up with things somewhere on your list you can't do because you haven't got the cash.
But of course, and that's exactly what I found at the County Council. But let's go back to the petitioning of government. The government has had its feet placed closely to the fire recently with all the atrocities we've seen in Europe. And as an emergency measure, the Chancellor said, OK, well, we're not going to reduce or make the planned 25% cuts to police budgets. There are still a real-time cut going on, but the 25% now has been put to one side. Now, that clearly indicates that money can be found if it's necessary. I think there needs to be a strong voice on the national stage, a strong voice that I'm prepared to give and have done in the past. So, for example, I championed the unfair funding for schools across the county. This is having a direct effect on our schools and provision of schooling. And we need to do exactly the same thing for policing. And I've spoken to the Chief Constable and said to him, if I'm elected, he must go and dust off his best suit and he and I will find our pals up and down the country. And we must make a concerted effort for money to be spent on policing. You know, the risk is going up, the number of people are going up, and yet the budget is going down. That makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever.
We spoke to Rupert Morse-Eckardt in the first half of this programme. He, like you, wants to reduce the harm factor in involved in crime. But as I'm sure you're aware, he very much differs with you on the subject of drugs, particularly cannabis. And you'll recall, of course, not that long ago that the Liberal Democrats voted to support the legalisation of cannabis. So a different, very much a different approach there. But partially to one side, though, what do you think under the present law should be done to reduce the influence of drugs, particularly, I think, on the streets of Cambridge? I know there's other parts of the county where drugs remain a problem, Wisbeach, I guess Huntingdon to a lesser extent there. In Cambridge, we seem to have an issue where you basically have the dealers coming up from London and plying their wares on the streets here. How do we reduce that?
Well, I think, first of all, we must send a very strong signal to those that wish to deal in illegal drugs that Cambridgeshire will be the most unfriendly county in the country for you. Two police constables ago, Julie Spence, had a policy called a door-a-day policy, in which every single day of the year, a drug dealer somewhere in this county had their front doors opened forcibly, and their lives were made miseries in the same way that the people who suffer from drug abuse their lives are made a misery now. And I would like to reinstall that policy. Secondly, we need to chase and work with partners around our county to work out where the drugs are really coming from. And you say London, but it's not just London anymore.
I'm sure there's plenty of other places. But presumably you would need to work with those forces as well.
We absolutely need to work with those forces with the aim of disrupting the drug supply. And if you talk to most officers, at the bottom of most crime, there's a drug habit somewhere. And it's not good enough just to say that we're prepared to legalise it, because what that does is send a very mixed message to our young people. I'm a good bit younger than, a good bit older rather than most. And I remember when I joined the RAF in 1977, I was told quite clearly by a great big burly warrant officer, you're caught with drugs, you're out of this Air Force. And, you know, I was terrified of that. I was terrified of him and the concept of losing my job. And I've never to this day ever taken an illegal substance of any sort. And I think that message was very clear to me. And I stayed away from it, despite going to parties where it was available. I didn't dare take it. Now, at the moment, we seem to be saying to our young people, some of these drugs are safe, some aren't safe, some are illegal, some aren't illegal. And any mixed message will always have...
It's interesting. Do you think there are mixed messages around? Because often in the news, there's an athlete, there was a footballer in the news recently. He failed a drugs test, but in this instance, this was weight drugs, weight loss drugs, fat burning. Another time it might be, oh, I had a cold remedy. You know, do you think that in public life generally that there's too many excuses made for drugs?
I think so. I think the battle against drug use is a very difficult one. And there, of course, there are people will say there are sort of personal choice issues at stake there. But ultimately, drugs do a harm. They put a pressure on our social services, onto the NHS, onto our police services, and increasingly, our people are taking drugs in preference to alcohol and driving on the roads. Now, this is a harm, and therefore we should say, as a society, this is not acceptable and we don't do it. And you're right, the examples in sport, people cheating by taking drugs, however they've taken them, it's the wrong thing to do. And I think people will normally accept that. The trouble is, those that are in power sometimes decide that this is a battle we can't win, and just making something legal doesn't make the harm go away, because people will still take drugs and drive, and that's a real danger for the people of Cambridgeshire.
And Julie Spencer's Door a Day campaign, of course, were you to revive that or something similar, would give visibility for you. Is that important in terms of making it seen to be doing something?
It's not important for me, because I'm not going into this post about me. This is about what's important for the people of Cambridgeshire. But I think it's absolutely right that people are reassured that the police officers are carrying out their duties, that they can see it, they hear about it. And a lot of what I hear, particularly in the rural areas, is that rural crime is scary. People are feeling isolated. They believe the police won't respond and don't come out. They don't believe they're being listened to and therefore not reporting crimes. So our crime statistics at the moment are being distorted by lack of people reporting them. And it's made worse by the fact the 101 service is poor. You can wait, according to the Chief Constable, for 35 minutes for the actual doing bit of the phone call. Mm. So it is important. There is something symbolic about doing things in tackling harm and crime, and you know, just passively doing it in the background, dealing with some other forms of crime without being seen, doesn't always tick all the boxes.
I would like to talk about the visibility of the police and crime commissioner. You'll be aware, I'm sure, that the last elections, I think the turnout was very low. This time around, of course, we benefit from it not being in the middle of November. We get to have it alongside the local elections, where people are already coming out the door for one set of votes. So they'll be taking the opportunity, perhaps, to vote in both elections. At least we'd like to think so. But the role itself, in many areas of the country, it's been a little lost. And I'm sure that in if you go pick a man in the street or a woman in the street and ask them as to who the crime commissioner was in any part of the country, many of them would struggle.
I totally agree. But I think you'd probably get exactly the same answer if you asked a question about the old police authorities, actually. And they were not democratically
elected. Which is, of course, commissioner role effectively replaces in part, at least.
Replaces all of it. No, absolutely. But there were 17 people there, and I used to be an independent member of the police authority. And I was appointed, you know, selected and appointed. Nothing democratic about that whatsoever. Although there were 9 county councillors. But, of course, they were put there largely through patronage, but nothing to do with being... They couldn't be held to account necessarily in that role. So I think the Police and Crime Commissioner is what we've got. You have to stand and be elected, so that's good, and you can be accountable. But it is lamentable of the poor visibility we've seen since we've had the very first Police and Crime Commissioner. It has been by almost all opinion across all parties that the role has been invisible. Nobody knows who he is. Nobody knows what he's doing. And part of this role is about saying to people, if you get the right person with the right views, you can be empowered. And one of the things I want to do is to make sure that, you know, the Chief Constable's priorities include the low level antisocial behaviour, illegal drugs, parking on pavements and speeding that people say to me across the county are blighting their lives. Now,
and do you then is it important then to be seen to have done that? I don't necessarily want the picture of the crime commissioner presenting every single school sports day that's available, but I think what people would want to see is a success, but for some of the items that you mention, and for others, with or without a picture of the crime commissioner, but certainly associating the man who has done something with it.
Yeah, but again, it shouldn't be about the individual, I don't believe. That's not what this is about, from my perspective. But you're absolutely right to say, if the public are spending some of their hard-earned money on this particular role, what are they getting for it? And they need to understand that he exists, that he's doing something. I mean, currently, we have... a PCC who, for some reason, has moved his offices into Camborne, you know, at a cost of £26,000 a year, when offices were available over at Hinchinbrook. We've seen his...
Where did you put your offices? Back in Hinchinbrook, one would assume.
If you imagine this role is a little bit like a chairman of the board and your chief constable is your chief executive, you need to be in almost daily contact to be able to understand what's going on and to influence and to make sure that things are happening. But we've seen the Police and Crime Commissioner office go from 6 staff to 17, from £350,000 cost to £650,000.
How many staff do you think it needs?
I think it had 6 under the police authority. There's some jobs that have been transferred into it from the constabulary that justify it. But I would think about 10 would be a reasonable number. But you know, we've got two separate press offices, or one for the Police and Crime Commissioner, one for the constabulary. What's that about? Absolute waste of money.
Making the Police and Crime Commissioner distinctive, surely, and keeping him an arm's length from the force.
But you don't need to do that. Remember, you're working as a team with tension to make sure you deliver the very best outcomes for the people of Cambridgeshire. You know, the police is almost the most over-regulated organisation that we have. You've got a chief constable, deputy chief constable, assistant chief constable, a chief financial officer and a press officer. On the PCC side, you've got a police and crime commissioner. At the moment, you've got his deputy, you've got a chief executive, and you've got yet more press officers, you know, and a CFO. This is bizarre. You don't need to. I've already discussed it with the chief constable, and a number of those posts can go from day one.
Okay. I'd like to ask you a question that I put to Rupert a little earlier on. You'll be familiar, of course, as we all are, with the tragic events in Hillsborough and the aftermath, which has been in the news over the past few days. The Police and Crime Commissioner for South Yorkshire, Dr. Alan Billings, has suspended, as you know, the Chief Constable up there, David Crompton. The intervention came after, I think, Theresa May's speech, the Home Secretary and the Commons, and also general public calls which had come for the Constable, Chief Constable's resignation. How would you have handled it?
What, right now?
No, right now. With putting aside the tragic events of Hillsborough itself, reaction of David Crompton in the past few weeks.
Look, the police have to protect us and they have to be open and transparent, and I don't think we necessarily see enough of that across all the constabularies. So you'd expect a chief constable to be honest and open in his responses to any event. The fact that it appears that he was defending the undefensible at the time would obviously put his position in jeopardy. So I think certainly an investigation. I'm not close enough to the facts to say whether the suspension was the right thing or not, but I would certainly be inclined to think that it probably is the right thing. I think the public are demanding some action. Equally, I wouldn't want to see the current chief constable be a fall guy for failure of activity and dishonesty all those years ago.
Okay. Ever been a victim of crime yourself?
Victim of crime? Yeah, I've had things stolen from me before.
Mm. Did you involve? Did you involve the police at that time?
I was in the RAF at the time. The RAF police got involved.
Ah, they had their own. Is it military police or a section of it, I guess?
No, Royal Air Force police. Yeah. Yes, I've had my car, or a number of cars, damaged. One in Cambridge 4 years ago, scratched right down the side. Queen Anne Car Park, I did report it to the police. They sent me to go off and try and find the video footage.
Were you successful in tracking it down?
No, I had to go to the council offices then, I think, and so it went on. And it turns out that the tape wasn't working, or my car was obscured from it. So yeah. A lot of time spent on my part, but no results.
Oh dear. You've been, we mentioned earlier, on the county council as leader for the Conservatives. You lost your seat and then joined UKIP. What have you been doing in the intervening period?
Well, I've played an awful lot of golf. I play 5 days a week now. I've set up a couple of small companies as well, just to keep the grey matter ticking over. But
doing what?
One's a marketing company. That's the biggest one, really. Yeah. I've been doing all the things that I probably should have done when I sold the company back in 2008/9. Actually, plenty of time thinking. Working through what I want to do for the rest of my life, and of course preparing in some ways for this role.
Well, the election is in a few days' time. Wish you the best of luck, as we do to all of the candidates taking part. Nick Clark, Thank you very much for joining us in the election studio. We're asking all of our guests, you're the last of the four of those standing, to pick a song. What do you have in mind?
I'd like to pick Purple Rain, the obvious colour, by Prince. Rest in peace.
Thanks very much.